feel free to ask questions. I'll try to see you in the in the chat while we go on. I've got a board here. I'm going to move there for a second. Oh, I can see that's okay. Slightly out of range, but that's what we need to see. What they need to see is what they're seeing. So let me change the view to to the board for a second, and let me move over there. Okay. Well, what happened? Cancel. Okay, there we go. Let me see if this is working. Okay, well, today is not my day. Pen isn't working, so I'm just going to desist on doing that. I'm going to go back to what we're going to do. I'm going to use a presentation. If I run out of breath, it's because it's really hard to talk all the time under the mask. Please bear with me. We're going to cover American literature in this subject from the very beginning, from the pioneers, as Douglas was saying. We've got a student that's American, so he's going to provide a lot of perspective and insight. And I hope that you participate during the course with your own experience, and that way we create a healthy debate and a healthy environment of exchanging ideas. My purpose is to try to give you the enough information for you to pass the subject, but also to acquire enough knowledge about North American literature, and not only an understanding but a lightening for such an interesting part of universal literature. We're going to start today with John Smith. Today is the first part of our course. We're going to talk about the origins of American literature, which, as a matter of fact, is previous to what we can consider the United States as a nation, and that is going to be the fact for at least the first four authors. The first four authors that we see here that we're going to cover over the course of October: Captain John Smith, William Bradford and Bradstreet, Mary Rowlandson are authors that are born in England. They travel as settlers, as pioneers, in the case of Captain John Smith as an explorer, and they're trailblazers. And what we're going to see in the first periods are people that are really groundbreaking in terms of what they add to a non-existent American literature. Captain John Smith is a very relevant map maker, very relevant explorer, and a writer where some part of his work is under dispute in terms of reliability. And that's it's a very good way of starting, because it's going to give us grounds to debate about how reliable a narrator has to be, if reliability is important or not, what it adds and what it subtracts from the narrative that he is telling us. The beginning of the course is going to be highly influenced by Puritan religion, as can only be the case, because Puritanism is extremely relevant and extremely influential for American culture and American religious tradition. And we're going to see how all the beginning of the course, all this initial part over here that we see, is imbued by this religiousness. We're going to see how religiousness stops being relevant over the time that America stops being a colony of the English Empire and achieves independence. The War of Independence is going to be like a turn of tide, also influenced by a time of revolution, a time of enlightenment, and Obviously, that is going to bring a new, fresher perspective that is going to include a non-religious point of view of the world, and it's going to bring, it's going to open literature in a broader scope, and it's going to go beyond factual accounts to embark in the territory of fiction. So the more we step away from religion, the more we're going to step into fiction, the more we're going to step into a sense of originality and freshness that that American literature achieves over the period that is considered Romanticism. What we're going to see in the first term is, we can call it proto-Romanticism. It's like the what takes place before Romanticism really steps in and is very relevant around a century into American literature. We can say that the peak of Romanticism happens around 1850. 1850, if you open your history books or if you remember what you studied in American history, is a relevant time because it's right before the American Civil War, and therefore we have that bracket of time between the early colonizers and the independents, which is strongly Puritan, the period of time that goes from the moment where religion stops being predominant to this period of the 1850s, where Romanticism sweeps in and not only takes the American stage but takes the entire world a very relevant source of literature. American literature turns into something relevant not only for the English speaking countries but for the entire world, because of the format, the short story, a device that is presented by Washington Irving, and because of its unique settings and unique topics that we're going to see time and time again. What are unique topics? Well, for example, in Unit 4, we have Mary Rowlandson, Captivity Narratives. To be able to write about captivity narratives, you had to be in a frontier land where the possibility of being held hostage by Native Americans was possible. So that turns into the first distinctly American genre. We were talking about Captain John Smith, who's a true trailblazer and a pioneer. His map-making ability and his exploring ability probably have gained him a higher reputation than his reputation as an author. We're going to see how relevant his work of as an author was for the moment, but why it's probably lost its importance over time. The second author is equally interesting, William Bradford. That's a name that slipped my mind before when I was talking to Douglas. William Bradford is one of the Pilgrim Fathers. He's probably the most relevant of the Pilgrim Fathers. He was a governor for over 30 years, and he gives us a great first-hand account of what it was like to be a pilgrim over the course of time, thanks to the work that is purely Puritan. And Puritans have a specific agenda. They don't write for any reason. They write when there is a didactic purpose in writing, and when there is something to be learned by generations. So in these first authors that are strongly imbued by religion, we're going to see that the purpose of writing is to educate future generations. So there is a sense of leaving annals, leaving a chronicle of their time for the future generations to profit from it. In the case of Captain John Smith, we don't see that intention, because he's actually, he doesn't belong to that religious community. He's separate from that religious community. And that's going to be a very interesting first glimpse at the importance of American literature. What are we going to see after we see the first four authors of early American literature? Well, we see these that Puritanism starts to wane. Today it's going to be a, we're going to talk about John Smith, but I'm going, also going to overview the entire semester so I can help you get a better grasp of what we're going to see over the course of the next few months. Puritanism loses predominance. And why does it lose predominance? Because a generation of American-born people grow into power and don't share exactly or don't meet eye to eye with the strongly conservative orthodox principles of Puritan religion. So Puritanism loses its predominance, and there is an attempt in the religious world to revive that sentiment. That sentiment of revival is called the Great Awakening, and it takes place at the same time as the rest of the world is embarked in the Age of Enlightenment. So nothing could sound more contradictory than a religious awakening clashing with the Age of Enlightenment. We're going to have a fantastic case, Jonathan Edwards, where he manages to combine some of the tenets of Enlightenment with some of the principles of religious awakening. So Jonathan Edwards is a very important writer slash preacher that we're going to have the opportunity to discover and enjoy at the beginning of November. Counter opposed to Jonathan Edwards, because some of these authors sometimes are better studied in comparison with another one, we have Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin is the polymath. He's an incredibly interesting character, and I think that we could fill an entire course of two semesters only talking about Benjamin Franklin. We're going to narrow the scope incredibly. We're going to forget that he's a founding father, ambassador to France, the only signee of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the peace treaty, the entire thing. He's one of the founding fathers of the American nation, a very important inventor and sage, and all of the we're going to focus solely on his role as a writer and what he provides to American literature, a sense of Americanness. And this is probably the first time where we're going to grasp that concept of Americanness in Benjamin Franklin, which which goes through a period where he goes from being openly and pro-British to embracing American independence. And even though that process is completely independent to this course and it's beyond the scope of this course, it's a very interesting process, a vital process that he had and other thousands of Americans had. And they witnessed the birth of a nation. In the case of the next two authors, Olauda Equiano and Phyllis Wheatley, we have the opportunity to talk about slave narratives and how important slave narratives are for understanding American literature. The slave narrative only in the case of Olauda Equiano, because in the case of Phyllis Wheatley, what we're going to see is the first American black poet, which resembles the strife of the black population, regardless of whether they were enslaved or they were freed. Freedom as such was just a condition of their terrible suffering, and even if they achieved theoretical freedom from the bonds of slavery, they still had to endure so many trials in life that it was almost impossible to succeed in life and carry on a normal life. Is that the first poet that we're going to talk about? No, by no means. In the third unit, I quickly went over her Ann Bradstreet is the first poet that we're going to read about. Ann Bradstreet is actually, she can actually be considered an exiled British poet if we came close to that, but she's also considered the grandmother of American poetry and a pioneer in using poetry within the Puritan framework, which is a paradox in itself, how Puritanism, which was contrary to artificial forms of writing, to fiction, would accept a poet within its ranks, and how she manages to be to stay faithful to Puritan principles and continue writing poetry and being accepted by a very, very conservative society. After we cover these eight first units, we're going to get to December, where there's the final stretch of the course. We have Washington Irving, the forefather of short stories, very, very relevant figure. I don't remember your name, Julio. Julio was telling me that Washington Irving was an author that he was familiar with. Of course he is, because one of Washington Irving's most relevant works was a work about Alhambra, Tales of Alhambra. Is probably one of the most important works of the time in about Spain in the English language, and it's impossible to go to Granada without seeing a gazillion copies on the in every single bookstore and gift shop in all the languages you can imagine. Washington Irving is much more than just that. Peculiar writer that spent a great deal of years in Spain and had first-hand experience of monumental Granada. Washington Irving is going to be the reference for the big triumvirate of romantic writers that are probably at the core of romanticism in American literature: Nathaniel Hawthorne, Edgar Allan Poe, and Herman Melville. And those three writers are obviously influenced by Washington Irving. Only by Washington Irving, I would say a clear no. Ralph Waldo Emerson is a really, really important author, which nowadays is basically unknown, because I think the type of writing that he did had a lot to do with philosophical reflection and a type of poetry that is seldom read nowadays. So Emerson represents a school of thought called transcendentalism, and the transcendentalists are considered a part of romanticism, but have a distinct flavor. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote about transcendentalism. He was a theorist of what transcendentalism was, but who really proved that he could not only talk the talk, but walk the walk. We have Henry David Thoreau. Henry David Thoreau is a pure transcendentalist. He lived by transcendentalist principles. Nowadays, transcendentalists are celebrated because they are pioneers in terms like keeping a balance with nature, living from from whatever you're able to produce. Trying to walk away from consumerism and a lot of topics that sound very fresh, very current, but that were exposed in the 19th century. Henry David Thoreau is probably one of the most important figures that we have in American literature, because he is considered the inventor of civil protest, and he is considered a key reference and a key influence for people like Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King. Sorry, I'm losing my breath a little by little. In the middle of these four authors, I would say we have probably one of the most sellable authors that we have here, and probably the first blockbuster writer that we have in American literature. But I would say, from the literary point of view, one of the least interesting, which is kind of paradoxical. We have James Fenimore Cooper, who wrote about the Native American experience, but from a highly fictionalized point of view, and with a certain agenda and some underlying factors that make his work highly criticized by scholars nowadays because of the bias that it produces and because it is considered the origin of many of the stigmas that have separated America in terms of racial diversity and how the paradigm, for example, of the good Indian and the bad Indian was first portrayed in his works, and how influential, from a negative perspective, that has been for the generations. I don't know if you have any questions so far. People in the chat, wow, 13, we've got a great attendance so far. I think there's like 60 people in the course to have maybe like 25% of the people. That's great. It's a great attendance. Well, I would say that everything that we see in this course is literary to an extent.
I know, but I mean, if I go to a bookstore,
like a chain, like a Emerson, yeah. Well, because normally it's a, Benjamin Franklin would have a point of view on that. Normally, it's going to be the... I don't know if everybody at home heard the question. The question is why some things are considered literature and other things aren't. Normally, it's because there's an agenda, because readers are... I'll repeat the questions. Thanks for your feedback. Publishers have the agenda of selling as many copies as possible, and they're going to strongly push the authors that they think are going to sell better. And as literature is considered a form of art, but also a form of entertainment, but philosophy, for example, is not considered a form of entertainment. Philosophy is probably not publicized in the same degree as a bestseller or what's considered literature. I think that could be an initial answer. From the look of your face, I don't think I convinced you very much. Okay. Yes, there is. Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. But there are universities that are becoming more open-minded, and maybe even starting a postdoctoral course on other authors that were normally considered minor authors. And we're going to see how taste has nothing to do with literary quality. And that's it's really good that you're talking about that. I'm going to repeat what Douglas just said. He was asking why some universities were never considered including in their curriculum of contemporary authors. An author like R.R. Martin, who is mostly famous for science fiction, I would say that that's a very, very shifting topic. And you as young scholars or as training scholars have to come to terms with the fact that it's in your hands to change that. I mean, traditional criticism is something that is constantly being contested. 50 years ago, a female author was not considered to be a great author just because she was a woman. And in our second semester, we have Kay Chapin. Kay Chapin was not able to publish novels during her lifetime because the choice of topics that she had for her novels was considered so scandalous that no one would publish her stories. Some of her stories are published have been published 100 years after her death, because she was so controversial for the time. She talked about consented adultery, extramatrimonial sex, casual sex, lesbianism, topics that were not considered appropriate or even acceptable in the 19th century. Her only novel, The Awakening, that we're going to talk about in the course, but it's not the story that we're going to read, was a huge flop. Why was it a flop? Because it went against the principles of the time. And those principles are set by not only the scholars, but society. And society is sometimes over-conservative, judgmental, and doesn't accept whatever falls out of the standard. Fortunately, we're in a time where literature is imbued by the same spirit that the rest of society is, and the opinion of one scholar can be contested by another scholar, and that's why when you study Comentario de Textos Literarios en Lengua Inglesa, you're going to see how there is a contestation of racial studies, feminism, queer studies. Those are all, I'm not accepting your point of view. I'm not accepting that you're going to say that there is good literature or bad literature based on the choice of topic, not based on the literary quality. I would say more. If we go back to this list, why are some of these authors forgotten in time? Because they don't add up, they don't provide sufficient relevant material to the current conversation. This is probably not the best set of examples, because all of these authors have something that is distinctly relevant for them. But when we get into the second semester and we start to see the big romantics, Longfellow was a superstar in his time. Longfellow, a poet. He's one of the fireside poets. Superstar. He was like a rock star of the time. Have you ever heard about Longfellow? Then you like poetry? Probably pretty much. If you don't like poetry, you haven't heard about Longfellow. You've probably read a poem or two of Longfellow, but you've read Emily Dickinson's a whole set of poems. Emily Dickinson never published in life. Edgar Allan Poe died in poverty and was tremendously unsuccessful because literary quality and the taste of the time don't always go hand in hand. And some authors die unable to publish or to be recognized as successful. A case that is parallel to R.R. Martin's case is Tolkien. Tolkien is a very successful author after death, but during his lifetime he wasn't as successful. He wasn't an established best-selling author. I think that could probably address part of the question. Yeah. They always say, die young, leave a beautiful curse. Live fast, die young. Okay, well, we're going to dive into Captain John Smith. Let me first talk about what materials we're going to use in class, what materials you should have. My covers are different, but the book is exactly the same. I think that this one still looks the same when you buy it. You can pick this up at the library if you don't have it. They have several copies. This is a study guide. The study guide is not supplementary. I would say it's necessary in this subject in particular. Okay, because of the style it has, it is not absolutely compulsory. The compulsory work is this. But I'll always reference every single unit. I'll make a reference at the beginning of the unit. Of the learning objective of each of the authors. There's a small focus on some of the elements, and if you've seen the PEC, the Prueba de Evaluación Continua, the instructions refer you to the study guide explicitly. So I would say that the study guide is a necessary a part of your material. This is a textbook. The modern one has like brownish covers. I don't know why, because this one's really cool. This is what I use as a student. I mean, I wasn't sitting here. I was in room 7, and the first day I sat in class and I heard the lecturer talking about American literature. I said, this is what I want to do. So I'm living the dream, and I'm happy enough to have my student book using it as the manual that we're using for the course. The content of this book, if you buy it secondhand, is exactly the same as the one. It's just a republishing. Maybe they've corrected a few typos, but this book has very few typos. The author of both books is the teacher that will probably correct your exam, Professor Givet. And this manual is a fantastic compilation of everything you need to pass the subject. Everything you need to pass the subject is here. What we're going to do here is just give you more insight on what's contained in this book. So my job is to... Yes, I would say 95% is this. 95% of the knowledge that you're going to extract is this. What does this have that I think is awesome? It has an incredibly concise and well-written literary glossary at the end. Every unit focuses on a different skill that a literary scholar should manage. So I think it's really interesting. For example, let me see. Unit 1 talks about what an exploratory question is and how to approach them. Number 2 talks about something that is normally part of every PEC and every exam, how to compare and how to contrast. If you get a question in the PEC, in the Prima de Evaluación Continua, that says compare and contrast two authors, and you decide to write about one author, then write about the other, and then submit, that is a failed type of answer, because you're expected to look for the bridges and the cracks between the authors that you're asked about. And it used to be mainly about two authors. Recently, in the recent years, it's normally about three authors, because in every term there's 12 authors, and it seems kind of unfair to only ask about 4 or 5 and leave 6 or 7 out of the picture. So what they're doing in recent times is extending the amount of authors that are included in each question. For example, talk about the way nature is represented in William Bradford, in Ralph Waldo Emerson, and in Henry David Thoreau. And you have to compare if you find any similarities between the three and any differences between the three. And that's, but always from the point of view of what's contained in this book. You're not expected to read the entire body of work of each of these authors, because that would be incredibly long and impossible to manage in a 1-year course. You're expected to know the contents of each author. So my recommendation, my strong recommendation, is for you to try to read the text before we come to class. If I have time in every class, I'm going to read the text here out loud. So whoever's not very is a bit lazy and hasn't read the work gets that job done. I mean, I'm trying to make things as easy as possible, and maybe stop and comment on certain passages that I find relevant. And I have seen from experience that are part of the exam material, one way or the other. Small warning for you here and for the people at home. The class ends at 7 minutes before the theoretical ending time, because they have to come to disinfect the room. We're expected to evacuate the room as if it was an earthquake drill. I mean, I'm from San Francisco. For me, it's always an earthquake drill. Or if it were a fire drill. I'm going to try to manage time. It's not my strongest point, so I'll fail miserably most of the time, and I'll probably have to end abruptly. If I do, I'll try to complete the things in the forum and give you and provide any answers of any topics that were still in discussion. What I said, the American literature book, the study guide for the American Literature book. They're must-haves in your collection. I normally read a lot about from this book. This is a copy I picked up from Amazon secondhand, really, really worn out. It's called From Puritanism to Postmodernism. In my opinion, it's probably the book that really frames the entire period, not only of this course, but even contemporary literature, the other American literature subject that you have in the course. Is it compulsory to have? No, by no means. This is something that I do because I think it provides an external perspective. And one of the things that I think is a limitation of this course is that every single author is segmented into a unit. So sometimes we tend to lose a perspective of knowing which authors lived at the same time as others, which authors received a direct influence. It's the first reference in the extended bibliography. Okay, so I can recommend you to pick it up from the library. I think there's a copy here and two copies in the Biblioteca Central. I think that all of you are from Madrid. If you aren't, maybe you have a local library where you can pick it up. My recommendation, Amazon secondhand books. I got this one for €3. So, I mean, I think the shipping was more expensive than the book itself. So, if you want a good book on American literature, this is probably the best to have. Okay, so very strong recommendation because I love this book. But it's a personal choice more than something. Yes, can I write the title of the book? This is called From Puritanism to Postmodernism. And I think it's Penguin. Yeah, it's a Penguin book. It's in the extended bibliography, so you should be able to quickly find it, okay? If you have any questions, just text me in the forum and I'll answer your questions. So far, I hope the sound quality is adequate for those of you at home. Every time that we come to class, I'm going to provide in advance a presentation with a few slides just to help you structure the ideas, maybe bring key points that you have to take into consideration. After the class, I would love it if you just went to the forum and debated on the ideas that you found more interesting or less interesting, and you extended the usefulness of the class to a group discussion that, for obvious reasons, it's more difficult to have this year in the classroom environment because we're isolated and I only have two brave soldiers here to keep me company. In this case, what I try to do with these quotes that I bring at the beginning of each set of slides is something that frames the chain of thought of the author. In this case, the quote is, "Heaven and earth never agreed better to frame a place for man's habitation, were it fully manured and inhabited by industrious people." This is by Captain John Smith, and as you can see, he lived not very long beyond the time where he was on American soil. He was in the area of Jamestown around 1608, 1609. He was expelled dishonorably. He was arrested while being there. He was court-martialed. Apparently, he was sentenced to death by an Indian tribe, and he was saved by a so-called lady, that according to legend was called Pocahontas. That story, to put it mildly, is in dispute, and it seems like a great piece of science fiction that John Smith produced years after being in America. Please, Douglas. Yes, but in this case, it means prosperous enough, prepared for agricultural means. Okay, so it is manured in that sense. But it's What do we have with Captain John Smith? We probably have one of the biggest publicity campaigns of all times. Captain John Smith's work can be seen as a 17th century infomercial in terms of it was his exploring and map making was the biggest magnet that attracted settlers and pioneers that moved not only from England, but from most, from many places in Western Europe to a newfound land that, according to his account, was very dangerous, but the rewards for being there were enormous. 4 years before the pilgrims arrived to America, and we're going to see the pilgrims in the next units, the pilgrims are normally considered the beginning of American history. Douglas can probably share with me that when we were in school, for us, American history starts when the Mayflower hits Plymouth, and that's just not so. Many things happened before that, and what you have to understand is that England arrived late to the scramble for American soil, and it was vastly outnumbered for a serious amount of decades by the Spanish superpower that dominated the naval operations, and also by the French. So the French and the American, basically, and also the Portuguese, of course, the Portuguese had a very strong grasp on American territory, and the only part that was left when their naval power started to diminish that they could try to create those routes were American territory to the west and through the endless routes to the east of the world, trying to find territories, and that's why the quest for Australian for a foothold on Australia and parts of Africa and parts of India starts at more or less the same time, because it's only when French and Spanish power diminishes that England can expand and look for those routes from a very different perspective that Spanish, for example, the Spanish conquistadores had. For Spain, the mission was to accumulate wealth, to accumulate resources and expand territorially, to acquire territory that was immediately added to the empire. For the British, it's a way of licensing. It's a way of licensing for limited periods of time to people that are willing to leave their motherland and try to reach a territory where they have very few years to make as much money as they can from the crops, from the minerals they can extract from the earth, or from other sources of wealth such as furs or other elements. But basically, during the first decades, it's about that. It's about traveling to territories that are pre-licensed, so not anybody could go to America. You had to ask for a royal license, which you had to pay in advance, and you had a designated territory that you could exploit for a number of years. Yes, but in England, that was the only purpose. It wasn't a drive to create English territory in a different area of the world. It was a way of expanding the wealth of the British Empire. As a matter of fact, one of the points that makes the relationship between the colonies and Great Britain go sour so quickly is the fact that they have no power over their own territory. They have absolutely no representation in the British Parliament, and they have no say over their taxation, over their their way of entering in trade deals with other territories. So at the end of the day, they look for a break in that relationship, and that's what sparks the War of Independence. It's not about nationality. It's not about a national sentiment at first. It's more about a taxation problem that turns into a search for independence and a search for an own identity. But that identity is something like it's something that they find along the way. It's not something that is part of the initial drive to begin a conflict with Great Britain. It's just something that scales beyond control. In the case of John Smith, if you've read the work of John Smith, he's trying to bring an account of Virginia, and when we say Virginia, we have to consider that Virginia is Virginia, Rhode Island, Maryland, Pennsylvania. It's a huge territory. It's like everything that was there was Virginia. And he's trying to make an account that is written from his perspective. He's a military man, and from that point of view, he talks about the inhabitants of America from the point of view of a soldier, of how they organize, what their rituals are, how they rank their armies, how they organize the defense of their towns, etc., etc. Not from the point of view of describing so much the territory. He does that also, but that's this contrast between what he finds interesting, the things that are interesting for a soldier, and what would probably be the most convenient thing to do if he really wanted to talk about the newfound land as something attractive for pioneers. What makes it attractive for pioneers? His maps. His maps are not only useful tools of information for settlers and colonizers. They're some of the most accurate maps of the time. With very few resources, he proves to be a very skilled map maker. And his map of Virginia has a duration of 70 years as the best map of the territory. His map of New England is one of the most accurate maps, and it can actually be held against the current—the real map of the area north of Virginia, in the territories of the north, and Massachusetts and all the area of Jersey. I don't remember how north it how much it goes north, and it still holds a great deal of relevance. I've added the two maps so you have a look at them, and you can come to your own conclusions. From the point of view of how we're going to talk about the author, we're going to do something similar to what Professor Givert does in the book. We're going to go over the objectives of the unit. The objectives of the unit are normally taken from the study guide. The objectives of the unit is what the big ideas you should walk away with. And in this unit, it says that the first objective that we have to walk away with is understanding how unfamiliar and inhospitable the environment of the New World was for the arriving English explorers. They didn't have to worry only about not engaging with the French or with the Spanish, but they also had to worry about what was going to wait for them there. It was a terrible trip across the ocean, and I think that with this unit and the next unit, you're going to understand the ordeal that it was to arrive to America. So this sense of hostility and unexplored territory, which can have a deterring effect, but it can also be something that is attractive for exploring souls, and also something that is very important from the very beginning, the religious importance of the difference between America and Great Britain. What are the key elements that distinguishes America from Britain is that America accepts freedom of religion, freedom of faith. So that freedom is fundamental for attracting all of the people that suffer from religious persecution. If you've read or if you've studied the importance of religion in Anglican Britain, you can understand that that even though there was a certain degree of tolerance towards other forms of Christianism, there was also a lot of persecution, and some of those people that were persecuted for holding other ideas, for example, in the case of the Puritans, first they had to flee to the Netherlands, and then they ended up hiring a vessel to transport them to America. So one of the strongest points in favor of embracing the information that John Smith was providing was that promise of religious freedom that America provided. And that's why we're going to see that Puritans flock to America in droves because they finally find an English-speaking territory where they don't have to worry about the persecution. And they embrace the idea with a certain degree of religious fanatism. It is a fanatic religious following, because they embrace America, and we'll see that next week, as if they were the chosen people arriving to the chosen land in a sort of rewriting of the Bible, and comparing themselves with the Israelites and their strife to find the promised land that God will deliver to them. So there is a great deal of religion involved in the people that use the Captain John Smith work to arrive to America. Was Captain John Smith religious? No, he just wasn't. He was a soldier, had a great deal of military experience, but he was by no means religious, and there is very little beyond the typical writing formulas that include God in the writing that bring us to the conclusion that he had very strong religious feelings. We're going to also see, well, how Captain John Smith is above all considered an adventurer and an explorer. He inaugurates American travel writing tradition, something that becomes very important over the course of time in American literature. And this travel writing experience provides new sources of not only information, but entertainment to a readership that wants to know more about exotic places, which is everything that is outside of Europe. So the source material is also engaging as a form of entertainment, and travel writing tradition probably has its origin in American literature due to the work of Captain John Smith and how he chronicled the early days of colonization in America. We're going to see something that is very important. This is probably a key word in this course, this manifest destiny, this idea of manifest destiny. Manifest destiny is a European idea, and we can never connect the idea of manifest destiny directly to Captain John Smith. in with that wording of manifest destiny, because manifest destiny is a term that was coined in the 19th century. But as a concept, it was extremely obvious that the idea that people that arrived to America had, that it was their predestined right to take hold and control everything that they found. It's a very Eurocentric idea of having the idea that everything that you colonize is colonized for the first time. Everyone that preceded you were ungodly savages that deserved being pushed out of their territory, and if they resisted, being exterminated. And that idea of having the manifest destiny is one of the founding seeds of the American dream, the idea of the West, the idea of the frontier, all of these ideas that are imported from Europe, but turn into the core values of the American feeling, of that early American sentiment. That Americanness that is still nothing, it's an embryo, is born with this idea of the manifest destiny, of everything that is west of the shore of Cape Cod or Plymouth or whichever point you want to reference in the eastern coast. Everything west is yours for the taking, and it's just a matter of providing sufficient manpower, gunpower, or whatever means necessary to take what is yours. And that is going to be a driving force, not only for the early settlers, but for the entire concept of Americanness. And is it unique to American sentiment? No, of course not. The same way we talk about Americanness, we talk about Englishness and how they believed during the 19th century that it was their, not their God-given right, their God-given obligation to go to the foreign territories and to re-educate people into a civilized way, taking home all the resources they could in the process. So we're going to see how first this idea of landing to America clashes very quickly with the pressure that the Native Americans suffer from being moved more and more towards the West, first on the East Coast, provoking wars, provoking hunger, provoking mass migrations, provoking a lot of suffering for the benefit of the white population that was arriving and that had God-given rights to occupy that territory and expel whoever was previously occupying that territory. So all the beautiful ideas that stem from Thanksgiving and all of that, well, it's more of a fabrication than something that has to do with reality. The reality was that the Indians, the Native Americans, served the purpose while they served the purpose. I mean, the moment they weren't useful, there were too many, they were too close, they were just pushed away. Same thing that we can talk about the Native Americans, we could talk about other superpowers that were in the territory, and that is just the way that European superpowers have managed themselves over the course of time. It's not something distinct from Captain John Smith in particular. But Captain John Smith, if you go back to the quote, it's, here is a land that is yours for the taking. No one's here. Maybe these red-colored people, but I'm sure that we can come to a peaceful agreement that they'll move a few hundred miles to the west for no reason at all, even though they've been here since the beginning of time. Well, that idea that there was a perfect place for habitation was an enormous magnet for people, but didn't take into consideration that there was a pre-existing population there that was denied any right of possessing the land, and possession was only a God-given right that Europeans had. And that's a concept that was later worded as manifest destiny. Very key, very important key concept that you should be able to manage. We're going to talk about how the native peoples of America are portrayed by by the English explorers, and how we start to create a stigma and a negative concept about them from the very beginning, because there is us and the others, and that otherness that we that you're going to study a lot about in post-colonial literature, for example, is the idea that everyone that that isn't like you is less of a human being, has less rights, and has a lesser degree of civilization, of intelligence, of rights than you do. And it starts to create that idea that it's us, the civilized people, and then the indigenous, diabolic, devilish. And that's probably the only segue to religion, to connect the idea of Native American to the idea of devilish and godly people. Exactly, yes, to connect them to a concept that they don't deserve any type of mercy because they're not creatures of God. They're ungodly creatures, they're devilish, they have bad intentions, and therefore we should manipulate them as much as possible for whatever purpose we have, and exterminate them when they become useless. We're going to see the myth of Pocahontas and how Captain John Smith rewrites a story that that is suspiciously similar to a story of Hernán Cortés with La Malinche. Yes, exactly, with La Malinche, and how the story of Pocahontas surfaces only several years after Captain John Smith has left America. So it's not a fresh story that he tells while he's there, and he comes back telling it. Many years later, out of nowhere, there's a rewriting of his own story where he includes this story of Pocahontas and how he is saved from a certain death. And that's the text that we're that we're dealing with today, that saves him from certain death. And the rhetorical process of self-representation and self-fashioning. Captain John Smith was incredibly boastful. He would speak about himself in the highest degree. He spoke about himself in the third person. Writing about yourself in the third person is an enormous warning sign that there's a huge ego behind that writer, and that he's probably going to portray himself as the hero of the story. And what we have here in the case of Captain John Smith's account is a story that is suspiciously close to being a science fiction bestseller of the 17th century, about a superhero that against all odds was pardoned by the Native Americans, and was able to avoid certain death, a certain death after an incredible amount of his fellow explorers were killed in the days before he was pardoned. So we see a story that is highly suspicious of being unreliable, and in the moment we find a crack in the surface. We start to see that everything that he says could hold some degree of deviation from the facts, and therefore we don't know how much we can trust or not from his account of the matters. It does give a sense of being objective. Another thing is that it's really objective. I mean, in the case of William Bradford, for example, he rarely writes about himself, and he never mentions himself. He talks about the group of people, the pilgrims call themselves the saints. He talks about the saints in the third person because he wants to create a tone in the story that has a biblical tone. In the case of Captain John Smith, it was also maybe an attempt to create something that sounded objective and that sounded neutral. But at the same time, when you see that one character is highlighted over all the rest, and one character stands out as a hero, and that character is himself, it's very difficult to match that reliability with the sense of why he wrote like that. So it's up to you to believe him or not. But there are many factors in the story that show severe cracks of being something that you should take for fact and not think that there's a great deal of fiction imbued in that factual environment. He was commissioned to go. He was an experienced soldier, and he was kind of a rogue soldier. So he went beyond the line of duty, and in fact, when he returned from one of his exploring parties, he was court-martialed. He was dishonorably expelled from the colony. I'll find a way to extend this because this is the first day and it was really weird. It was hard to connect. I'll try to extend this. I'll add a second video where we talk about the work itself. But that's the takeaway that you have to have. But he is.
Here's a chance. This is my place. I'm the first guy to go there. Can I
even
write about myself?
What I did? Exactly. And then since he's going to write about himself, he's going to have the chance to say whatever he wants. Exactly. Yeah. Thank you, everybody. I'll record another video because today was kind of difficult to time manage. Thank you very much. Hugely honored by your attendance. I hope to live up to the expectation. Talk to you next week.